Your call is now live.
Wonderful. This is Caroline Fredrickson. I'm the director of the Washington Legislative Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, and thanks to everybody who's joined us today to discuss yet another round of negotiations on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I am joined here today by colleagues from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Kevin Bankston, who is a senior staff attorney at EFF and specializes in free speech and privacy law. He's going to speak to the issue of immunity, which is obviously very central to the whole deal that's being negotiated. And I'm also joined by Harvey Grossman of the ACLU of Illinois, who is the legal director in Illinois and has served in that capacity since 1980. And has served as legal counsel on a broad spectrum of civil liberties and civil rights litigation. Both Harvey will also speak about the litigation that the ACLU of Illinois has undertaken, and then we will open up for questions. We're also joined by two other people who are available for questions afterwards, Kurt Upsall, who's a senior staff attorney with EFF, and Michelle Richardson, who is legislative counsel with the ACLU, who are both experts on FISA and immunity. So let me just start and talk briefly about what we're hearing. I think most of you on the call know that Congress once again seems to be on the verge of negotiating away our basic constitutional protection. It's quite clear that the Democratic leadership in House and Senate has been in discussions with the White House about how to provide immunity for the telecommunications companies and how to ensure that the president has pretty much unfettered authority to engage in surveillance on Americans. And we're obviously very troubled by this. The House leadership was very courageous in February and rejected White House fear-mongering and allowed the very bad legislation, the Protect America Act, to expire. Now, it seems, not having learned from that experience, that it is actually good to stand up to the president, and people respect that and respect leadership when leadership is leading. So let's just talk very briefly about a couple of the concerns. You will hear from people negotiating this deal that there is more judicial oversight, both on the surveillance side and on the question of whether the telecommunications companies should be given a get-out-of-jail-free card. And that's clearly not the case. I'll leave it to Kevin and Harvey to speak more about the immunity provision, but did want to speak briefly about this, about the surveillance side, or what is in Title I. The bill still allows mass untargeted surveillance of Americans by permitting the government to gather all calls and emails coming into and out of the country. And we think that is a grave violation of Americans' rights. There is a presumption for prior court review, but the review is only of broad procedures, and any time there are so-called exigent circumstances, which are defined so loosely as to include any delay, and of course any time you go to a court, there's going to be a delay, no matter how brief. So that is the classic exception that swallows the rule. So that's one reason why we think that this bill is or the proposal that we've been hearing about is very, very concerning. And the other piece, of course, is the protections that are being provided for the telecommunications companies, really undercutting the accountability for both government and corporate malfeasance. And I think, you know, there are some people who say this was a necessary so-called trade-off between the immunity provision and our civil liberties. But it looks like it was all give from the Democratic side and all take from the Republican side. And it's hard to see where our Constitution has won in this exchange. So with that, I will turn it over to Kevin Bankston to discuss immunity and litigation that EFF has been engaged in. And before Kevin, you start, let me just mention that this call is being recorded, and that for any subsequent questions you might have after the call, of course you can ask questions on this call, but for later on you can call the ACLU press line at 202-675-2312 And EFF's press line is 415-436-9333, extension 125. And I will repeat these numbers again at the end. But with that, I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Thank you. Again, my name is Kevin Bankston, and I'm a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and one of the lead attorneys on Hefting v. AT&T, which is a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of the millions of AT&T customers, ordinary Americans, whose private domestic communications and communications records were illegally handed over to the National Security Agency by AT&T. EFF with ACLU has also been appointed as co-coordinating counsel for all 47 of the outstanding lawsuits concerning the President's warrantless surveillance program, including 35 other suits against telecoms like AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint for their illegal cooperation in the domestic spying. Now, I'm happy to give an update on the telecom litigation in Q&A. The short answer is that everything is currently stayed and nothing much of note is happening or has happened for several months. But that's not why I'm here this morning. I'm here this morning to warn that whatever gloss might be put on it, the so-called compromise on immunity for phone companies that broke the law is anything but a compromise, and that Congress appears poised to needlessly toss the rule of law out the window and deprive these millions of ordinary Americans of their day in court. My one simple message is that no matter how they spin it, this is still immunity, period. Indeed, there's an easy litmus test that everyone can use when evaluating this proposal or any other. Does it allow the court to rule on the legality of the surveillance? That is, does it allow the plaintiffs to obtain a public decision on whether the companies broke the law, and if they did, to get an injunction to stop them from breaking the law again? If the answer is no, then it's still immunity, plain and simple. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this impending deal on immunity brokered by between House Majority Leader Hoyer, the White House, and key Republicans. And there's been a lot of talk that the Republicans have given ground on immunity and have made meaningful concessions. Indeed, the negotiators have been quite successful at having their spin repeated in the press, that the federal courts will be allowed to decide whether the phone companies should get immunity, or whether they are entitled to immunity, or my favorite, whether they deserve immunity. These talking points foster the impression that there will actually be meaningful court review of what the phone companies did and whether it was legal. They foster the false impression that there will still be accountability. I'm here to cut through the spin and say that based on a review of Senator Bond's earlier draft proposal from several weeks ago, based on reports from congressional staff close to the negotiations, and based on the more detailed news reports, the plain fact is that this supposed compromise is still immunity, same as it ever was. And anyone who opposed the immunity passed by the Senate in February should oppose this one too, because in the end, it's just the same, except for a few sham concessions meant to fool immunity opponents. I think Senators Dodd and Feingold summed up the deal best in their letter to congressional leaders last week. As they pointed out under this so-called compromise, quote, the court's role would be limited to evaluating precisely the same question laid out in the Senate bill, whether a company received a written request or directive from the Attorney General or the head of an element of the intelligence community indicating that the activity was authorized by the President and determined to be lawful. By who, it doesn't say. If the Attorney General certifies that fact to the court, it must dismiss the cases, and the courthouse door will be closed to millions of ordinary Americans seeking to vindicate their privacy rights. Now, of course, we already know from the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on its bill that just such written quote requests, stating that the surveillance was authorized by the President and had been determined to be lawful, were provided to the companies. In other words, the only question the court has the power to review is a question that we already know the answer to. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether the court reviews the Attorney General's certification for abuse of discretion, as in the Senate bill, or requires that it be supported by a preponderance of the evidence, as in the Bond proposal, or by substantial evidence, as the latest reports describe the current compromise language. The standard could be beyond a reasonable doubt, and the result would be the same, immunity. Or, as Senators Dodd and Feingold put it, regardless of how much information it is permitted to review, what standard of review is employed, how open the proceedings are, and what role the plaintiff's lawyers are permitted to play, the court would be required to grant immunity. To agree to such a proposal, they conclude, and we agree, would not represent a reasonable compromise. They're right. It's not a compromise. It's pure theater. The big question is, why is Congress doing this? Well, it's doing this because the President is placing the interests of the telcos ahead of the safety of the American people by refusing to sign a foreign intelligence surveillance bill that doesn't contain immunity. Yet the issue of retroactive immunity is completely irrelevant to the question of whether and how the surveillance laws should be amended going forward. Now, the administration has long claimed that failing to grant this retroactive immunity would endanger these companies' cooperation with lawful surveillance in the future. But that claim has already been disproven. As the administration itself admits, all of the companies have been complying with the surveillance directives issued under the Protect America Act. Frankly, the only future cooperation threatened by holding the telcos accountable now is cooperation that violates the law. Because immunity sends the message to the phone companies that it's all right to ignore the law next time they get a slip of paper saying the president thinks it's okay. Even if, as in this case, the surveillance plainly violates multiple longstanding privacy statutes and the Constitution itself. Congress should not reward these lawbreakers or help the White House cover up and avoid a ruling that its surveillance program broke the law. Instead, we call on Democratic leaders, especially House Speaker Pelosi and Senator Obama, to call the president's bluff. There's simply no need to give this lame duck White House a going-away present in the form of immunity if the issue is national security. Rather, any purported intelligence gap that may arise as some Protect America Act orders begin to expire in August could easily be corrected simply by passing a bill to extend those orders. To be clear, we opposed the PAA, and we'd prefer to see these orders expire, but if it's a choice between extending those orders or unnecessarily passing a dangerous and radical rewrite of the surveillance laws and giving the phone companies a get-out-of-jail-free card, the choice is obvious. And if congressional Republicans oppose that extension or the president vetoes it, then the voting public will know which party cares most about the rights and the safety of ordinary Americans. Which raises one last question that I leave to you, the press. Why did the administration fail to renew the existing Protect America Act orders or issue new ones in February before the PAA expired? This supposed intelligence crisis that will reach ahead in August wouldn't be an issue at all if the Attorney General had just issued new orders. Did the administration simply forget to do so, which would be the height of negligence? Did it decide that the orders that would expire in August were no longer necessary to protect the American people, in which case there is no crisis? Or did it simply decide that creating an artificial intelligence gap was worth the danger to the American people so long as it could be used to force the passage of immunity for the administration's telco friends? In the days to come, I hope you'll demand an answer to that question. In the meantime, I just wanted to let you know before I wrap up that one of the ordinary Americans represented in our lawsuit, Tosh Hefting, the Hefting and Hefting versus AT&T, is available and eager to talk to the press about his motivations for bringing suit and his objections to immunity. Despite the Republican talking points, he's no trial lawyer looking to line his pockets. For that matter, neither am I. I'm a salaried nonprofit worker. But he is an average citizen, representing millions more, who is demanding that the rule of law be upheld and that those who violated his rights be held accountable. So if you'd like to speak with him, please call our press line, and we'll make that happen. Thanks, and I look forward to your question.
Great. Thank you so much, Kevin. And I think you very well described what is the chutes and ladders of the immunity proposal, although unfortunately for any plaintiffs, it's just chutes. And so let me turn it over to Harvey, who will similarly discuss immunity and the ACLU litigation.
Thank you. And thank all of you for calling in today. My name is Harvey Grossman, and I am co-coordinator, as Kevin described it, in all of the consolidated cases against the telecoms that have been transferred to the Federal District Court in San Francisco. Our case was brought on behalf of Stutz Terkel and his colleagues against the AT&T, and it also is a class action. Stutz and his colleagues, of course, have been here before. They've been the subjects of unlawful government surveillance based simply on their own lawful political activities. In fact, Stutz, as many of you may know, was the victim of the same kind of conspiracy between government and private corporations that we're challenging in these cases. Stutz lost his job during the McCarthy period on network radio because he had supported efforts directed against Jim Crow laws in the South. The government and the networks conspired to create the blacklist that kicked Stutz out of his employment. We challenge the telecom's disobedience to the law with knowledge that we've all been here before, that we've learned from the past, and that this government, and indeed any future government, will be prone to disobey the law, to assert unbridled executive authority, to cajole, to coerce, and even demand cooperation from government, from private entities in violating the rule of law. In fact, immunity for the telecoms now guarantees future violations of the law. Even the FISA that's envisioned in the present negotiations is unlikely to be complied with as long as there's a get-out-of-jail-free card for the telecoms at the end of the day. Through our clients' decades of experience as active citizens and leaders in our community, they know the harms that are committed when the executive is not, in fact, fully bridled in their assertion of authority, and particularly when they're given passes by other branches of government and checks and balances are eliminated. Immunity is unnecessary. The process that is contemplated by the negotiations in issue is really the very one that would take place in the case, in the courtroom anyway, with one clear exception. The government would produce whatever papers or directives it is that it issued to the telecoms, but the court would not decide whether the paper exists, because that's the only review that the present negotiations contemplate. Instead, the court would simply, behind closed doors, determine whether, in fact, the paper complied with existing FISA. That's not a difficult process to contemplate, and in a short period of time, we'd all know whether the law was complied with, accountability would be restored to our system, and the rule of law would prevail. There is nothing but a sham court hearing that's contemplated under the present negotiations, and I think Kevin has adequately addressed that. But in the end of the day, what we won't know is why did the telecoms do it? And that, I would suggest to you, is an inquiry that the executive branch, the president, does not want a court to get into. Because if we look at the underlying documentation and find it to be so wanting, so far from compliance with existing law, then other questions will be raised about the telecom's intentions. You know, were they acting as patriots, or were they acting under the kinds of pressures that heavily regulated industries sometimes do? The telecom industry is a very, very complex player in our political process, and the full measure of sunlight guaranteed by the court proceedings as they presently are contemplated under existing law is the only thing that will guarantee freedom and assurances of future protections in the law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harvey. And clearly, I think Harvey and Kevin have laid out very clearly why what we see is not judicial oversight, neither Title I or Title II, either in the surveillance or in the telecom immunity sections of this bill. But in fact, it's just theater. It's just been just sort of the trappings of judicial review, but the reality of no accountability and practically immediate dismissal of cases. And that really will undermine the checks and balances that have heretofore been in existence in FISA. So with that, we will open it up to questions. And again, we have Michelle Richardson and Kurt Opshaw here to answer additional questions. And we will now take your call or take your questions.
At this time, if you have a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone phone. Only press 1 once or you will be removed from the queue. And please hold a moment. Okay, it looks like our first question is from Corey Bowles with Dow Jones News. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. How you doing? I'm wondering if, from your perspective, you think that Senator Obama has done enough, said enough in public and perhaps in private, in terms of urging Democrats in Congress not to strike a deal of the type that's being leaked all over the place, and whether or not, if he hasn't, if you think he needs to do more.
Well, this is Caroline, and Kevin might want to speak to this too, but obviously Senator Obama was very strong throughout the fall in the debates that were going on in the Senate, and joined Senator Dodd and Senator Feingold in opposing the immunity provision and signed up for a filibuster of that provision. So he has been very strong. He's been pretty busy. Besides that, it's hard for us to know exactly what's been going on behind the scenes, but so far as I know, he's not changed his position on immunity and remains opposed to giving these companies, the get-out-of-jail-free card that we've all mentioned.
Yes, I would just like to thank Senator Obama for his stalwart opposition to immunity but certainly would call on him to be as vocal as possible in that opposition in the coming days and weeks, and to lead his party on this issue.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question is from Ryan Singel with Wired.com.
Hi, guys. Any idea, have you heard anything about what's the possible schedule for this to go forward? Does it sound as if the leadership, including Congresswoman Pelosi, is behind the compromise?
Well, this is Caroline. I think what we're hearing is that, you know, what they keep saying is the deal could be announced any minute, and it still hasn't been announced in terms of actually laying it out so that people can really analyze it, and so members can determine whether they're going to support it or not. But I think, you know, I don't know whether Speaker Pelosi or the Majority Leader, Mr. Reid, will support this legislation, but I think the onus is on them to determine whether or not it actually gets scheduled for a vote. And if they oppose it, I think the onus is on them not to schedule it for a vote.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Our next question is from Tim Starks with CQ. Please go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to throw out some feedback about what you've been saying from the Hill. They've been, various aides have been saying, how is the ACLU and all these organizations criticizing this deal before it's done? The language is still being written, et cetera. What would you say to that?
Well, first, I'd say that it's a bit bad form to criticize us for not having seen the bill when they're the ones not letting us see the bill. If we can't comment on it until they show it, which may be the day before or the day of the vote, I guess they expect us to just hold our tongues until then, but we will not. As I explained in my statement, our analysis is based on both the bond proposal, which we've seen, the more detailed and accurate, apparently accurate, descriptions in the press, as well as our own contacts with staff who are close to the negotiation.
Yeah, and this is Caroline. I'd say exactly the same thing. I mean, and we have seen a draft. It may not be the latest draft, but certainly the broad outlines of the proposal are well known, I think, to everybody. And no one has denied that the framework of review that we've discussed, the idea that you know, as Harvey said, the court would look at whether the paper exists or not. And, of course, we all know that the paper exists. And so the outcome is foreordained. It's a fait accompli, basically. You know, I don't think anybody's contested that fact. And again, as Kevin said, we're happy to do a review. We'd love to be wrong if they wanted to show us something to the contrary. You know, we'd be eager to see it.
Yeah, exactly. I would say if it's not immunity, guys, prove us wrong. Give us the language. Let us see it, and then we can talk about it like rational adults.
And I think just as one final point on this is that it's clear that the White House has said no legislation would pass without immunity. The White House seems to be blessing this deal. Ergo, the proposal included in this deal is immunity.
Okay, and it looks like we have another question from Ryan Singel. Ryan, please go ahead.
I know we're mostly talking immunity here, but what are you hearing about the differences between the House and the Senate bill in terms of being able to do wiretapping on American soil with fairly broad basket-type orders? The House and Senate bills are fairly different on how that works.
Hi, Ryan. This is Michelle Richardson with the ACLU. Well, you know, both House and Senate bills from the beginning have always included mass untargeted surveillance on American soil, giving the government the ability to collect every phone call and every email coming into or out of the United States. So on that point alone, we're already so far into unconstitutional behavior, the procedures by which that is done becomes less relevant. Now, if you want to compare the House and the Senate bills, one difference was prior court review of the so-called basket or blanket warrants. that don't identify who's being tapped, the facilities that are going to be used, or what's going to be done with the information. But the latest draft that we've seen, embodied by the bond proposal, had a giant loophole. They had an exigent circumstances out, which allowed the government to go up on entire programs of surveillance without prior court review. They would apply after the fact, but, you know, there's a little secret hidden in this bond proposal. It says that even if a court says no, it denies an order either in advance or after an emergency, the government can keep tapping and use everything it gets through the entire application and appeal process, which can go on for months. So the courts don't even have the authority here to stop it, even if they find a grave constitutional violation. At this point, the court review is so meaningless that we're back to square one with the Senate bill, where the court can maybe rubber stamp something, but they're not really going to have a meaningful role.
Thanks, Michelle.
Okay, once again, if you do have a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone phone. Only press 1 once or you will be removed from the queue. Okay, we do have a question from Julian Sanchez with ARS Technica. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we're seeing any signs of the kind of public blitz that we got back at the beginning of the year. In the form of these sort of 24-style ads. I mean, are the House Dems trying to head off a sort of second round of that in August?
Well, this is Caroline again. I think I would just say to that, you know, the Protect America Act expired in February. House leadership stood up to the president, pushed back, and said no to fear-mongering and said yes to protecting the Constitution. They actually got kudos from their constituents after that happened, and I think, you know, we would hope that they would have learned a very profound lesson from that episode, that it's better to do what's right and people will support you in doing what's right than do what's wrong and think that you're somehow going to avoid being criticized by the president. So, I wouldn't doubt that that there will be an effort to mount some kind of a campaign, but again, there were no punches landed when the Democrats stood up to the president in February, and in fact, they gained a lot of ground. So that's what we're advocating for them to do now. As Kevin said, they have other options besides taking this bad proposal and making it into permanent law. They could actually do something much more limited, targeted, that would sunset in the next year.
Okay, our next question comes from David Wilma with NPR. Please go ahead.
Hi. I was talking with Majority Leader Hoyer this morning about the fact that he's bringing this compromise to the House floor and asked him why not wait until there's a new president who would actually be using this law. And he said, well, we can't wait because there are Democrats who would be pressuring to vote on the Senate-passed FISA bill. And so we have to offer them another option. There's this discharge petition that's out there. How do you respond to that?
Well, one, there is another option, which is if they feel like they have to do something, which, again, we don't quite understand the basis for that, but they could extend the orders if they were not, in fact, extended. As Kevin mentioned, it's sort of incomprehensible that the administration wouldn't have done that, so perhaps it did, actually. But they could extend the orders under the Protect America Act. They could extend the Protect America Act. Again, we oppose that, but for a short-term extension, that would be an option. And I'm not sure why that wouldn't satisfy people. The president might object because it doesn't have immunity, but if the Democrats are objecting because they want something that will theoretically keep America safer, then it should answer that. And so that's what I would say to Mr. Hoyer. The other thing I would say is that there haven't been any new names added to the discharge petition, so I'm not really sure what he means by additional pressure.
Okay, once again, if you do have a question, please press 1 on your touch-tone phone. Only press 1 once. Just a few more seconds. And it does not look like we have any further questions.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for joining us. And again, of course, we are all available And as Kevin said, the EFF has plaintiffs and the ACLU also has plaintiffs. If you'd like to talk to them, please call our press lines. ACLU press line is 202-675-2312, and EFF's press line is 415-436-9333, extension 125. So we look forward to hearing from all of you and answering any further questions you might have.
And this officially ends our call.